Lecture 21, Caesar's World War.
Last time we examined Caesar's unparalleled siege operations at Alesia in 52 BC. In this lecture, we stay with Caesar and survey several of his greatest but perhaps less celebrated military triumphs, the battles of his civil war with his political rival, Pompey. Of the many engagements that made up this conflict, we shall focus on five. Our main source for the events covered in this lecture is Caesar himself, although his own account breaks off in 48 BC, but it was supplemented in antiquity with an author or authors unknown, but clearly people who were Caesarian partisans. These works then provide us with a continuous contemporary account, albeit from a somewhat biased perspective. Before proceeding, a quick review of the main changes in the Roman army of the late Republic is in order. The general Marius is given credit for many reforms at the end of the 2nd century BC, but some stem from the following century or appear to have been long-term trends rather than one-time enactments. Marius certainly opened the ranks permanently to the dispossessed, who had been enrolled previously only in times of extreme emergency. The propertied citizen militia, providing its own equipment then, gradually gave way to state-equipped soldiers who looked on military service as a career in and of itself. State-supplied equipment led to more uniformity, and the old distinction between hastati, principes, and triarii evaporated, even if, in typical Roman fashion, there was a reluctance to abandon the use of these actual terms. But all legionaries came to be armed in a similar fashion, with two javelins and the short sword. Coats of mail became the standard body armour, and the oval shield gradually became more rectangular. The spear-wielding triarii and the legionary light-armed disappeared almost entirely in the face of the new uniformity. Marius is also said to have made a change in the javelin itself, the pilum, remember, so that its piercing head actually detached from the shaft on impact. Since the meaningful distinctions between hastati, principes, and triarii had now vanished, the usual maniple, or the former maniple, gave way to a new tactical unit, the cohort. Now, as we saw in Lecture 17, the cohort already existed as an administrative entity, but now it became the primary tactical unit made up of six centuries. Centuries were also increased across the board from 60 to 80 strong, so that a cohort had 480 men in it. 10 cohorts then made up a legion of 4,800. So dominant had the cohort become by the 1st century BC that Caesar often refers to whole armies not by the number of legions in them, but by the number of cohorts. The cohort was commanded by the most senior centurion in its ranks, and a hierarchy of centurional status ranged down from him through each cohort and then by cohort down through the legion. In this way, then, the leading centurion of the first cohort was the most senior centurion in the legion, and the other centurions of the first cohort were more exalted than the rest. Tribunes continued as staff officers, but they were no longer elected by the popular assemblies. Rather, now they were appointed by the consuls. From references in Caesar and elsewhere, it seems that the old tripartite battle line, called the Accius Triplex, was retained, although no longer made up of distinctly equipped troops. It appears that the centuries did the tactical job of the maniples, ranged by their cohorts from front to back of the battle line, rather than laterally down its length, as the maniples used to have been. Thus, rather than a front line of men called hastati, and then a second line of soldiers called principes, and so on, there was now a front line made up of the forwardmost centuries of all 10 cohorts, and then a second and third line of centuries indistinguishable in their equipment from the first. Not every general used this triple line, of course, and we do hear of double or single line deployments. It is thus not immediately obvious whether the transition from maniple to cohort increased or impaired the legion's tactical flexibility, although I suspect it probably improved it. Another reform credited to Marius is the standardization of legionary eagles. Formerly, a variety of standards has signified the legion, often with different animals on top. The eagle, the wolf, horse, boar, or the mythical minotaur, all creatures representing strength, speed, and aggression. Now Marius made the eagle the sole symbol of the legion. It became a matter of great shame to have the eagle lost or captured in battle. Each century also had its own standard, although there does not seem to have been a standard specifically for the cohort. Since battle honours were actually attached to the standards, a unit history began to accumulate, giving the men a strong sense of loyalty to their century and then also to their legion. This unit-based pride is most clearly manifested in the military gravestones of the imperial period, where the deceased soldier often identifies himself by century and legion. Following the social war of 91 to 88 BC, when the whole of Italy became enfranchised as Roman citizens, the old distinction between citizen legions and the Italian non-citizen allies also disappeared. After 90 BC, all units raised in Italy, not necessarily those at Rome, were legionary in status. Citizen light-armed, missile specialists and cavalry units all but disappeared, so that citizen troops were now exclusively the heavy infantry of the legions. The Romans therefore looked to non-citizen troops drawn from subject peoples to fill the specialist gaps in their ranks. Cavalry and skirmishers from Numidia, Gaul or Germany, archers from Crete, or slingers from the Balearic Islands off the coast of Spain. By Caesar's day, such troops were being called auxilia, or literally, the help. And this is the name that they were to bear all throughout the imperial period. Auxiliaries, we call them in English. Overall, then, the trend in the century prior to Caesar's civil wars was toward professionalism. The landless, rank-and-file troops looked on the army as their path to wealth and respectability, and increasingly they relied on their generals to secure both. The troops could serve for 6 years, but often did so for far longer. We hear of one group that served for 24 years, although probably with a major turnover of personnel over that period. Such then was the character of the armies now ranged against each other under Caesar and Pompey. On the 10th of January 49 BC, Caesar crossed into Italy under arms and thus became an outlaw challenging the Roman Republic. His rival and former ally, Cnaeus Pompey, with the backing of the Senate, abandoned Rome and held levies in Italy to oppose him. But so swift was Caesar's advance that Pompey had to flee Italy altogether, and he headed east, where he enjoyed a multitude of patronal connections from his campaigns there in the 60s BC. The east was also immensely rich and could be expected to underwrite Pompey's war effort. If we believe Caesar's account, several vain attempts were made to seek a meeting with Pompey to resolve their quarrel peaceably. But Caesar's patience finally gave out, and he writes himself, "Caesar judged that he must give up the attempt tried so many times in vain, and wage war." The last phrase is ominous, since when Caesar put his mind to something, it was usually with complete concentration. Caesar had to wait for ships to arrive before chasing Pompey across the sea, but he wasted no time in idleness and hastened off to Spain, where he had heard that the lieutenants of Pompey were causing trouble. Spain was also a place where Pompey had connections, since he had commanded an army there for several years in the 70s BC. Caesar quickly outmaneuvered the Pompeian army in Spain and forced it to surrender before coming back to Italy and his main task. This whole Spanish operation, lasting perhaps 4 months, is typical of the boundless energy Caesar was to display in the coming years. Caesar's intention was to assail Pompey at his camp at a place called Dyrrachium across the Adriatic Sea in Greece. Having settled matters in Rome in January 48 BC, Caesar moved to South Italy and prepared to cross over to Greece. But he found insufficient ships there to transport all of his 12 legions and support troops. Pompey, in contrast, had used his eastern connections to assemble a large army and fleet. Caesar did land his first wave on the 5th of January 48 BC, but Pompey's fleet prevented the crossing of the rest. Caesar therefore found himself facing Pompey in Greece, stranded and outnumbered. His response was characteristically bold, but rather ill-advised. He penned Pompey up at the port of Dyrrachium, surrounded his position with forts, and then constructed siege lines to connect these forts. In vulnerable places, the siege lines were double or duplex, as at Alesia. In all, these entrenchments ran for some 17 miles when finished. Pompey responded by building interior contravallations of his own, thus slowing down the Caesarian efforts. Yet despite his army's exertions, Caesar's overall position was not good. Pompey had abundant supplies inside Dyrrachium and could expect more to come from the sea. Caesar, by contrast, had difficulty foraging, so that his men took to eating bread made from local roots. They would toss these loaves to the Pompeian soldiers as displays of their resolution to see the blockade through to a finish. It is reported that Pompey, when shown some of these loaves, exclaimed, "What beasts we are fighting against!" But he missed the point. Here were the veterans of Alesia and, as such, no strangers to hardship. Matters remained at a stalemate until two Gallic deserters from Caesar provided Pompey with vital intelligence about a weakness in Caesar's lines. So Pompey directed a major assault precisely at this point, which, being close to the sea, was also attacked by seaborne forces. The Pompeians would have carried the day and indeed ended the war had not a well-timed counterattack by Mark Antony, Caesar's lieutenant, staved the panic in Caesar's army. But Pompey nevertheless had seized a part of Caesar's lines and now entrenched the legion there, so that Caesar's overall position became precarious. Recognizing the danger, Caesar personally led an attack on this new Pompeian position and carried it. But when Pompey brought up his main force in support, Caesar faced annihilation. The sight of the massed serried ranks advancing in good order sparked a panic among Caesar's men. In fact, the situation was so bad that Caesar himself could not stop their flight. One standard bearer even lunged at Caesar, but was cut down by his bodyguards. Yet Pompey, overcautious, held back and failed to convert the advantage. It is reported that Caesar later said of this moment, "The war would have gone to the enemy today if they had a winner for a commander." Nevertheless, Caesar had lost 960 men, 32 officers, and 32 standards in the day's fighting. Caesar's boldness at Dyrrhachium in trying to invest a superior force supplied by the sea had almost ended in total catastrophe. Since his position there was no longer tenable, he disengaged and withdrew at night eastward toward Thessaly. Round one of the civil wars had gone to Pompey. En route from Dyrrhachium to Thessaly, Caesar was reinforced with two legions under the command of a chap called Cneius Domitius Calvinus, whom he had earlier sent over to Macedonia. This brought his army up to a total strength of 9 legions. This army, which he numbers at 22,000, so the legions must have been under strength, he confronted Pompey at Pharsalus. Here, Pompey's army, numbered by Caesar at 47,000, including 7,000 cavalry, was encamped on some foothills. Pompey's refusal to do battle for several days strengthened the self-confidence of Caesar's men. But finally, Pompey determined to fight and led his army out to contend the field. Pompey deployed his line with a stream to his right flank and all 7,000 of his cavalry on the left, supported by archers and slingers. Caesar reports that Pompey's battle plan hinged on his cavalry, which outnumbered Caesar's by 7-1. Pompey intended to sweep his horse around Caesar's right and roll up his line by an assault from the flank and rear. On the day, however, Caesar formed up in triple order battle line, but with two minor modifications. He ordered the third line to wait in reserve until he gave them the signal to attack. And from the third line, he withdrew 6 cohorts and formed a fourth line, which he stationed opposite Pompey's cavalry, but concealed behind his own right wing. Plutarch reports that Caesar gave these fourth liners special orders. When they engaged the enemy cavalry, they were not to release their javelins, but use them to stab at the riders' faces and eyes. Caesar knew that many Roman aristocrats rode with Pompey and reckoned that their vanity was not up to the test of hard fighting. Despite being outnumbered, Caesar's army had two major advantages over Pompey's. First, his was an army of battle-hardened veterans schooled in hardship in Gaul and outside Dyrrhachium. Caesar's habitual regimen of strict discipline also kept them finely honed and fit. In contrast, Pompey's army was comprised largely of inexperienced levies and included the sort of dandies that Caesar's fourth line had been ordered to cause some discomfort to. Second, Pompey's senior officers were not focused on the task at hand. Drawn from the upper reaches of the Roman nobility, Caesar reports that they were convinced of victory to such a high degree that they were already divvying up its rewards, the loot, the magistracies, and the various priesthoods. As Caesar puts it, they were not thinking about the means by which they might win, but how they ought to use their victory, is what he says. So their minds were not on the task at hand. The perfectionism of Caesar's army manifested itself in the battle's opening phase. Pompey had ordered his main force to hold position and receive the Caesarian onslaught in the hope that the long charge would wear out Caesar's troops and leave them ripe for the flanking maneuver that he had planned with his cavalry. Caesar's front two lines advanced but stopped halfway when they saw that Pompey's army was staying put. They gathered their strength and, not at all worn out, advanced to engage Pompey's troops along the entire front. Pompey's orders then had effectively ceded the initiative to his opponent. At this juncture, the Pompeian cavalry made its move and charged around Caesar's right. Caesar's 1,000 cavalry initially sustained this attack, but they were eventually overwhelmed since they were so outnumbered. But now the fourth line of 6 concealed cohorts swung into action and assailed Pompey's cavalry in the flank. The Pompeian horse fled the field, and the fourth line, keeping its good order, turned and attacked Pompey's infantry in the rear. So at this point, Caesar, with a perfect sense of timing, ordered his third line into attack, the final hammer blow to end the battle. The Pompeian army broke and fled. Caesar, on capturing their camp, comments on the luxuries he found there, which stood in sharp contrast to his own Spartan military order. Some of Pompey's supporters seem to have thought that the war was a rather distracting junket. Surveying the field scattered with 15,000 dead citizens and 200 of his own casualties, Caesar is reported to have said, "They wanted it this way." Pompey fled the field at Pharsalus and made his way to Egypt, where he strayed into a dynastic struggle between the boy prince Ptolemy and his sister Cleopatra. Ptolemy's advisors, seeking to gain Caesar's favour, had Pompey treacherously murdered and beheaded. Caesar, chasing Pompey to Egypt, himself became embroiled in the dynastic struggle, and he took the side of Cleopatra, so to speak, and found himself besieged by Ptolemy's forces in Alexandria. This kept him occupied until the summer of 47 BC, when events in Asia called for his close attention. For although Pompey himself was dead, his cause and many of his partisans remained at large. Caesar had a lot more fighting to do before the war would be won. Pharnaces was the king of Pontus on the northern coast of Turkey, and the son of the infamous Mithridates VI Eupator of Pontus, who had fought a series of bitter wars with Rome in the 80s, 70s and 60s BC. Following his father's model, Pharnaces took advantage of Rome's distraction and civil strife and seized some neighbouring lands. Depredations were then visited upon those Romans who were living in those lands. The danger was that the East would break out in a general uprising. Pharnaces had to be dealt with. So Caesar hastened to Pontus, collecting troops en route. The core of his force was his veteran 6th Legion, now depleted by losses to less than 1,000 men. In addition, he had the remnants of another Roman army in the area, 2 legions, and one raised by a local ruler called Deiotarus. This whole force cannot have amounted to much more than 16,000 men. As he bore down on Pontus, Pharnaces sent envoy after envoy pleading his case. This failed even to stop or slow down Caesar's advance. A confrontation was inevitable. On a high hill near the town of Zela, Pharnaces occupied a campsite formerly built by his father. Caesar arrived and saw an opening. A hill near Pharnaces' camp on the opposite side of a valley had been left unoccupied. So he seized these heights at night and set about fortifying the position. This action startled Pharnaces, who drew up his army out in front of his camp. Caesar regarded this move as nothing more than a show of force and kept his men busy with their fortification tasks. But incredibly, Pharnaces began to lead his army down into the intervening valley and then up the slope below Caesar's position. So bizarre and illogical was this move that Caesar was actually caught off guard. He had to pull the men hastily from digging, call them to arms, and draw them up before Pharnaces reached his position. The men were not properly in order when Pharnaces launched his dreaded scythe chariots, which added to the confusion but were dealt with easily enough by missile troops. Then the main lines engaged, and hard fighting ensued. But the Asians could not overcome the terrible topographical disadvantage their commander had imposed on them, and they were gradually pushed back. The sloping ground helped turn any backward movement into such a confused jumble that Caesar reports that some of Pharnaces' troops were actually knocked unconscious by those falling on top of them from up front. Pharnaces' army broke and was chased down into the valley and up the other side into their own camp, which was then promptly plundered by the Romans. After his defeat, Pharnaces fled and was later murdered by a compatriot. Now, it must be admitted that Zela was a battle more lost by Pharnaces than it was won by Caesar. Nevertheless, Caesar was elated by this easy victory handed to him on a platter by the sheer tactical ineptitude of Pharnaces. As a result, the whole campaign at Zela had lasted only 5 days. As Caesar's great triumph in August 46 BC, Zela was commemorated with the immortal words, "Veni, vidi, vici," "I came, saw, won," which aptly encapsulated the drive-by nature of this remarkable interlude. I say interlude because for all its spectacular swiftness, Zela was really a sideshow in the ongoing conflict with the remaining partisans of Pompey. The stage for the next installment of that struggle had been set in North Africa, where the Pompeians had been massing since the defeat at Pharsalus. So after a stop in Rome to settle matters there, Caesar headed off to Africa and his fifth major engagement in 3 years. The Pompeians had built up a formidable base in Africa under the gloriously named Quintus Caecilius Metellus Pius Scipio Nasica. This man had commanded the Pompeian center at Pharsalus and had fled to Africa following that great defeat. Also on hand were some other refugees, including Titus Labienus, Caesar's very able former lieutenant but now fighting for the Pompeians, Marcus Porcius Cato, a lifelong opponent of Caesar and Caesarism, and both of Pompey's surviving sons, Cneius and Sextus. Under these men, considerable forces on land and sea had been amassed in Africa. 14 legions, 120 elephants, huge numbers of light-armed and several fleets. Caesar, who initially only had 5 legions and 2,000 cavalry, would have his work cut out for him. Arriving in Africa, Caesar spent several months fighting minor engagements with Scipio and Labienus, neither of whom were willing to commit to a decisive confrontation. Many of these skirmishes are remarkable in their own right, since Caesar had to adapt to the novel equipment and tactics of the light-armed North Africans and the elephants. He also had to spend time retraining his troops to handle the unfamiliar stratagems and tactics of the cunning North Africans. By April 46 BC, Caesar had drawn his army up for battle on several occasions, but Scipio had refused to engage. Caesar then laid siege to the coastal town of Thapsus, home to a large Pompeian garrison. By this time, he had been reinforced sufficiently from Italy to be able to conduct such major operations. In response, Scipio was drawn out to protect Thapsus. His army, comprised of both Roman and native African troops, was somewhere in excess of 60,000 men strong and included a vast numerical superiority in cavalry and 90 elephants. Caesar had 10 legions at his disposal, but could only use 4.5 of them in the open field, since the rest were occupied investing Thapsus. If all the legions were at full strength, and if his auxilia are included, Caesar's army cannot have numbered much more than about 30,000 men. Scipio deployed in front of his main camp, with the elephants out front and on the wings. Caesar drew up in typical triple line order, but added a fourth line to each wing to oppose the elephants, and here also he stationed archers, slingers, and cavalry. These unleashed such a volley of missiles at the elephants that they turned and trampled their own lines before crashing into Scipio's camp, seeking respite from their torments. Then a strange thing happened. Caesar, the consummate general, lost control of his army. After so many fruitless months marching and encamping and besieging, Caesar's men were spoiling for a fight. Caesar tried to restrain them, but when a horn on the right wing signaled a charge entirely without orders, Caesar's legions launched themselves at Scipio's lines in a frenzy. So violent was the onslaught that Caesar could do little more than raise the signal, "Good luck, Felicitas," and let them go to it. Their charge broke the Pompeian lines on the first impact, and the Battle of Thapsus became a rout. The Pompeians sought refuge first in their own camp, then in the camp of their native allies, and finally on a hill. But Caesar's men were so enraged and filled with bloodlust that they cut them down relentlessly. Caesar reports that 10,000 Pompeians died to his 50, casualty figures which actually reflect the speed with which a decision was reached. Plutarch adds the alternative detail that Caesar was absent from the field, laid low by his epilepsy. If true, this might explain the uncharacteristic lack of discipline displayed by his troops at Thapsus. Against a firmer foe, such an impetuous charge could have spelled disaster. In reaction to the debacle at Thapsus, Cato, the spiritual leader of the opposition, committed suicide rather than fall into Caesar's hands. Pompey's sons reached Spain, as did Titus Labienus, to fight one last time against his former commander. Scipio also attempted to reach Spain, but was overtaken and surrounded by Caesarian ships en route. He perished in the ensuing engagement, possibly by his own hand. Thapsus ended Pompeian opposition in Africa. After a brief stop in Rome to settle affairs there and celebrate his great 3-day triumph in August 46 BC, Caesar headed out to Spain and the final showdown with Pompey's supporters. I note as a preface to what follows that the surviving account of the Spanish campaign is composed in a rough, colloquial Latin, suggesting an author of low education, possibly a centurion in Caesar's service, and so it offers a rather different perspective than the usual bird's-eye account of battles composed by Caesar himself. Caesar's return to Spain brought the civil wars full circle, since he had already settled the region, as we saw at the start, in 49 BC, before taking on Pompey at Dyrrhachium. But in the interim, an inept governor had so mismanaged the province that an attempt was made on his life, and some of the legions under his command were actually driven to mutiny. When Cneius Pompey, the son and namesake of Caesar's dead rival, landed in Spain, those legions chose him as their general. So mutinous Caesarians had been transformed into rebel Pompeians. They were soon joined by the refugees from Thapsus, and their ranks swelled to 13 legions. Spain had been converted into a Pompeian stronghold. Caesar arrived with 8 legions in November 46 BC, and as in North Africa, several months of campaigning and skirmishing were required before the Pompeians could be induced to fight a major engagement. This finally took place on the 17th of March near Munda in southern Spain. The Pompeians had taken up position on some high ground on the edge of a plain with a marshy area directly in front of their position. Caesar hoped that they would come down into the plain for a fight and fight it out fair and square. But they made no move to do so, so he advanced slowly on their position. On reaching the marshy ground, Caesar halted his advance. The famed 10th Legion, veterans of Gaul whom Caesar usually stationed in the place of honour on his right wing, raised the shout and battle was joined. It is left unclear whether or not Caesar gave the order to attack. Our possible centurion author clearly didn't know, so that detail is omitted. Since the Pompeians were fighting from higher ground, the battle favoured them initially, but the 10th Legion slowly began pushing the Pompeian left back up the hill. To prevent a breakthrough, young Pompey moved a legion from his right wing to reinforce his threatened left. When Caesar noted this, he increased the pressure on the Pompeian right with a cavalry charge. But bitter fighting continued, and the issue remained long in the balance. Caesar had to encourage his troops personally, shouting out whether they wanted to see him, Caesar, fall into the hands of mere boys, a reference to Cnaeus Pompey's youth. Eventually, the steadfastness and experience of Caesar's veterans stood them well, and the Pompeians broke and fled to Munda. It is reported that 30,000 Pompeians were killed, including Titus Labienus, to only 1,000 Caesarians. The precise figures are probably partisan fantasies, but clearly the Pompeians came off the worst of the fighting at Munda. Final ghastly detail does suggest that the battle had been especially bloody and tells us also something about the callousness reached by these Roman soldiers after years of fighting among themselves. Lacking material to build a palisade wall to lay siege to Munda, Caesar's troops erected a wall of corpses, discarded arms and heads. In April, Cnaeus Pompey was killed, given away by an informer as he hid in a cave. Pompey's other son, Sextus, survived and went on to have a very illustrious, if ill-starred, career as a pirate and ruler of Sicily, until he too lost his life in the civil wars of the next generation, those between Antony and Octavian, Caesar's successors. Munda left Caesar the last man standing in the civil wars with Pompey and his partisans. After Munda, Caesar remained in Spain until September 45 BC, when he came back to Rome triumphant. Puffed up by his own sense of indispensability, Caesar trod on the sensibilities of practically everybody in the city, so much so that even some of his own partisans joined the conspiracy that would take his life. Stabbed 23 times at a meeting of the Senate, Caesar died at the feet of a statue of Pompey the Great, against whom he had striven so mightily in the civil wars. It was the 15th of March 44 BC, 2 days shy of the 1 year anniversary of his final victory at Munda. So Caesar didn't even survive his final victory by 1 year. It is reported that Caesar said of the closely fought battle at Munda that he had often fought for victory, but only on that day had he fought for his life. In fact, the battle for Caesar's life had taken place not on any battlefield, but in the halls of power politics. And here, Caesar proved to be a dismal failure. The events surveyed in this lecture are as momentous as they are remarkable. In military terms, however, what comes through is the almost incredible energy of Gaius Julius Caesar. In the space of 5 years, Caesar personally commanded the legions at 6 major engagements and dozens of minor ones in Italy, Greece, Egypt, Turkey, North Africa, and Spain. In Roman terms, this was a world war that encompassed the length and breadth of the Mediterranean realm. But it was not enough for Caesar. Perhaps deluded by dreams of Alexander the Great, he was almost ready at the time of his murder to embark on an all-out campaign against the neighboring Parthian Empire to the east. In the next lecture, however, we divert our attention from the deserts of the east to the forests of the north, and one of the greatest defeats on record inflicted by native troops on disciplined soldiery.